If Vince called to apologize for throwing you under the bus, would you accept it?
No. After 40 years, he's going to call me and apologize? First thing, he ain't going to apologize to nobody for nothing. The only way he could apologize to me is go in the ring with me, lock the gates, put a cage around it. Two men enter, one man leave.
Welcome back to Dark Side of the Ring Unheard, the podcast from the Hit Vice TV series where we plunge into the Dark Side archives to uncover real revelations from some of professional wrestling's most storied characters, which have until now never been broadcast. I'm Jack Encarnacio from the Lapsed Fan Wrestling Podcast, joined by my Lapsed Fan co-host JP Sorrow, as well as Dark Side of the Ring's executive producer and co-creator Evan Husney, and also joining us for this episode, Evan's fellow Dark Side co-creator Jason Eisner. Dark Side of the Ring continues Tuesday, 10 p.m. Eastern on Vice TV, and the subject, Black Saturday, that infamous night in 1984 where Vince McMahon took over the Georgia Championship Wrestling telecast on WTBS after having bought the organization really under the cloak of secrecy without anybody having known it, marking a key point of aggression in Vince McMahon's national expansion of his World Wrestling Federation. And Evan, we're talking this episode about David Schultz. This from season two of Dark Side of the Ring. Dr. D, as he was known, a notorious bad guy, heel, villainous son of a bitch in the wrestling business. And his run-ins with Vince McMahon in 1984, also worth chewing on, speaking of that particular year in the next Dark Side episode. Please, just take us into what it was like connecting with Dr. D and all that you absorbed about how he's living these days.
Well, first off, man, that little cold open teaser line off the top got me real excited for tonight's episode. Oh, man, Dr. D, David Schultz, making that episode was such an unbelievable experience. Because, yeah, I mean, you know, he lives sequestered in a compound somewhere in Tennessee. He wouldn't let us reveal where in the episode. So it's in a generalized rural area of Tennessee. But we arrived at doing this episode, man. It was kind of a challenge in a lot of ways because that clip of Dr. D slapping John Stossel, you know, on 60 Minutes. So this was 60 Minutes, right?
It was 2020, years. ABC 2020.
2020, excuse me. 2020, man, when we first saw that, oh my God. You know, that clip had been viral since the dawn of the internet. And I remember seeing it, you know, years and years and years ago. And it was kind of this thing where it sort of recirculated for us in some way and was sort of thinking like, wow, could you do a whole 44-minute episode unpacking just, you know, 10 seconds of time? You know, could we make that a subject of an episode? And of course, you know, putting in some of Dr. D's bio and, of course, the fallout of that incident. And, you know, Jason and I are really also fascinated. Anytime the wrestling world sort of blurs the lines between reality and fiction. And this story definitely has that. You know, it gets into kayfabe, protecting the business, sticking up for the business, of course, and art that is long gone. And so for us, it was just a fascinating subject. And as soon as we got the go-ahead and the green light from Dr. D, which was not easy, man, it was definitely an audition period where we had to earn our stripes in order to do it. And it was actually Bruiser Brody's widow, Barbara Goodish, that actually stepped in and... Oh, wow. And gave him basically, you know, our recommendation and said, hey, these guys are cool. You should work with them. And that kind of opened the door for us. But as soon as that happened, we got the go ahead. The trip was pretty treacherous and getting there and not knowing what we were in store for. But Jason, I'll let you take it away to fill in some color on what that was like.
I remember when we were trying to like book the episode, we had heard from Barbara Goodish that like he was ready to tell a story. And so we were like excited. We thought, oh, wow, that would be amazing. And I think like as we got closer to the reality of it actually happening, I got the feeling that he was kind of trying to like discourage us from coming. And I remember like he said, well, if you're coming, you better get a snake kit because there's a lot of snakes out here. And like he made it seem like there was a good chance we were going to get bitten by snakes. And we were like freaked out to the point I remember going to the Walmart the night before and looking for like a snake bite kit. And I remember like the morning. We got up like super early. We were all super anxious and we wanted to get there like on time. And we're driving down these like back roads of like in the middle of nowhere, Tennessee, and like this like dirt roads, trying to find this place. And like he is hidden, like he's borderline like off the grid. And later found out it was because he was protecting him and his wife and his dogs from like a possible retaliation for like a past bounty. And eventually we did find him. He was like standing by his like front gate. And we pulled up, and I think we were like 1 or 2 minutes late.
Yeah.
And the first thing out of his mind, he was like, or out of his mouth, he was like looking at his watch, and he was just like, "You boys are late."
Yeah.
Like just right out the gate, like giving us a hard time and just like laying it into us.
And we knew, you know, there's loaded weapons on the property, you know, snakes, you know.
What you're saying is that he's a normal guy.
Yeah, he's actually a great guy, though.
Yeah.
Which we would later learn.
Yeah, but it took a while to get him, like, warmed up to us, I feel like. Like, I remember when we got there, he had this, like, storage container that he opened up for us. And it was the first thing we filmed. It's, like, the Verite stuff, like, in the episode. When he opened up this storage container, it was just, he kept all of his, like, wrestling memorabilia, all his old photographs. All the documents from his like past bounties and lawsuits, like
all the bounty hunter weapons that he utilized to, you know, stun and neutralize people.
Yeah, it was all in there. It was, and we were just, you know, like anytime, like we're at a wrestler's home and they've got like archive, you know, or like photo albums, anything, like we're just so excited. And
oh, yeah.
Like it, there was no way we were going to be able to get through everything that he had in there. So we were just like quickly trying to go through it, getting him to like pull out stuff that if he knew where it was in there. But that was amazing.
There's also one other detail too, which you didn't mention that I just recalled. It was sweltering in the middle of the summer, like suffocating heat. And he wanted us to not enter his home. That was a non-starter at the top of the day. So we were supposed to film this fucking interview for this show outside in like 110 degree weather, which he could survive easily. He was prepared to survive that weather. And we were just dying. And so I had to plead with him to be like, please, please let us go inside.
I was drenched. Like within 15 minutes, I totally sweated through my shirt. I was I was dripping on top of the camera because I'm also camera operating as well too. And
especially when we
were in that storage container, it was like being in a sauna.
It was horrible.
When you say he was prepared for outside, are you saying he was like naked, like covered in ice or something?
He's prepared for any element mentally. You know, he's mentally prepared to withstand any situation. You know, to bust through any wall, to kick down any door, and to survive any elements that the universe would provide him. He's a tough son of a bitch.
Yeah, and I think he grew up farming as well, too. So, So, like, he has been so climatized to that environment.
Yeah, he talked to you guys a lot about that. I think, you know, he comes from a family of people that would farm cotton and transport cotton and be in the cotton business. And, it doesn't get more Tennessee than that. So that's pretty wild. JP, I mean, you saw the episode and you saw the slap heard around the world where he hit John Stossel in the face.
Yes.
And of course, we'll get to that. But, you know, we've talked about Schultz over the years on Lapsed Fan, that famous jump from AWA to WWF with Hulk Hogan in late 83 to come to start with Vince McMahon Jr. in 84. I don't know. You've observed the man in his habitat, and we've heard Jason and Evan describe it. Your take.
Right out of the gate, you know what you're expecting when he says, like the very, very top of the episode, he says, "I may be an entertainer, I may be a con artist, but I am not a fake." And I was like, oh my, like, jeez, like, entertainer and con artist right out the gate. This is good shit, pal. I was blown away at his storytelling. I mean, it reminded me, I won't go into details of it, but it reminded me of when we met him at one of the StarCasts. And just hearing the stories that he said, he just, you know, when they get going, they just go and go and go and go. And he shared some dark accusations. That's all I'll say.
That's where I first met him too, at StarCast. And I remember being very intimidated and just like pacing in front of his table for like 20 or 30 minutes before I could get the courage to go up and talk to him. But I was like really interested at the time, like this idea of this episode wasn't in our heads at that time, but we had just made the Bruiser Brody episode and I knew he was friends with Brody. And I just wanted to like hear, you know, what his thoughts were about him. And he was like very like kind of standoffish at first, and then he warmed up to me, and then we walked down one of the hallways together and he shared some stories. But it's still like, even going into doing this episode, like all the anxiety was like, that stuff was like coming back. Like, and you know, he's much older than all, than me and Evan and our crew. And there wasn't a second, like we were there, like at his home that like, I didn't think that like if he wanted to, he could have just like killed all of us in a sec.
I imagine it's just a flip of a switch.
Yeah.
With him. Just like he senses something. He's like a, you know, he's like a guard dog.
Yes.
Senses something. You're done.
But the thing about him is that he also has this very teddy bear side, mm-hmm. you know, and he's very, like once he warmed up to us, like by the end of the day, I felt like we were totally ingratiated into the Dr. D world. Mm-hmm. And I remember too, because he was like, he was giving us some of his like homeopathic remedies for certain things, you know, for like, you know, you should take this and take that. And take
Yeah. He was like stretching me out. Cause like, I remember at that point we were on the road for a while and my back and my shoulders from camera operating were like so messed up and he could tell I was hurting. And he started stretching me out.
Oh, yeah.
And then he got some like, I don't know what you call it, but it's like stuff for horses. Like that you put on the muscles of horses when they're hurt. And he started rubbing that stuff like into me. And it was like, it's like that cooling gel, but it was like 20 times more powerful than like any other kind that I had before.
They call him like Dr. D. He was kind of the doctor. Yeah. In the locker room when the guys had, you know, problems with their necks or whatever or anything, he just like wrap a towel around you, yank, and you know, he was that kind of guy where he looked out for people when they were in pain.
Yeah, I told you guys that, you know, people think Dr. D is Dr. Death or something. No, it's just Dr. David, because I had everything you needed, you know, anything you needed to get through the rigors of the road in his pouch, his fanny pack or whatever. Well, before we dive into the wonderful archived material here with kind of a one-of-a-kind character in David Schultz, we are obliged, Evan, to get folks oriented for Black Saturday as we conclude yet another season of Dark Side of the Ring. This is an interesting one. This isn't just, you know, a biographical episode about someone that's been through a lot of ups and downs. This is really about that cloak and dagger behind-the-scenes stuff that is challenging to tackle. But what an idea to tackle a night where, just if you were down in Georgia as a wrestling fan in 1984, this was just the blackest night.
This is, for those who don't know, Black Saturday is the infamous day in wrestling history where Vince McMahon basically appeared on Georgia Championship Wrestling's show, taking over the time slot, which through, as you said, cloak and dagger methods of basically pushing out Ole Anderson out of the company, which we get into in the episode. He was the booker and one of the owners, the shareholders of the territory. And this is a story that's always been on our radar to tell because it's one of the most important stories for, you know, what how wrestling would go from the territories, this transitional moment from the territories into, you know, the sort of modern national monopoly of WWFE. With this story, this is Vince's kind of first chess move into the national expansion. And so for us, it was always really difficult to figure out how we could tell the story because not everybody is still around to tell the story who witnessed it and took part in it, you know, firsthand. But it was through meeting Gerald Briscoe along the way, you know, just to be friends of friends and starting to talk to him and him sort of warming up to us. I think it was because we had him on the Tales from the Territories episode of the Florida Territory episode. And we had him on and we just started talking like, hey, you know, Jerry, whenever you're ready, we'd love to do a Black Saturday episode. And it was kind of started with his blessing. Like once we knew we had Jerry, then we could really start piecing in all the other players into this and tell a very compelling story. So what you're going to see is you're going to see Gerald Briscoe. You're going to see Ole Anderson's son, who kind of speaks on behalf of his father. And he does a tremendous job at that. I have to give it to him. And you're going to see Jim Cornette as a historical voice. And some of the wrestlers, you know, who were there around the time. And you're also going to see Ole's assistant, or I think she was a secretary at the time, working in the offices. So a lot of just real, I think the episode, you know, came out great. Definitely has a sort of noirish cloak and dagger vibe to it, and that we really leaned into for the episode. And it's definitely an important story, you know, for I'm sure there's generations of wrestling fans that don't even know what it is. So you won't want to miss it.
Yeah, key to understanding how the WWE we know today, those initial early chess moves, as you put it, by Vince Jr. that his dad never would have dared do, that put him in a position to slowly but surely take over every territory in this country and nationalize the WWF at the time. So looking forward to that. We have a lot to get into here with the good doctor, however, so let us waste no more time. In terms of healing, this is a guy, and I don't mean the kind of healing he did to you, Jason. I mean H-E-E-L-I-N-G. This man was not only great at being a heel, he absolutely loved it. And here in this clip, he gives you guys a little flavor of the methods he would use in his time, you know, which was sort of the pre-national WWF that we were just talking about. The sort of old school, territory by territory, same fans in the first few rows every week. What are the kind of things you can do to get them riled up and keep them coming back?
I love being a bad guy. It's so easy to make people mad. You know, you call a woman fat, she gets mad at you. You call a man fat, he got a big beer gut, he gonna get mad at you. They stink, you tell them they stink, they're gonna get mad at you. They're ugly, you tell them they're ugly, they're gonna get mad at you. My God! Can't you afford a nice dress? Can't you afford a nice shirt? Can't you afford to eat at a nice restaurant instead of down here at some hog pen that I seen you at last week outside? I mean, come on. Take care of yourself. Look at your physique. You're fat, you're old, you're ugly, and your wife's ugly. They're going to get mad. They're going to be so mad at you they could kill you. Or they're going to come see you and hope you get beat. That's the only way they're going to see you get beat. And if you don't get beat, or you leave a question there, if you did get beat legally, they want you beat 1, 2, 3. They don't want you beat 1, 2, your foot go on the rope. A referee says 3, and my foot's on the rope. They don't want to see that. They want to see you 1, 2, 3. And I just love being a heel, man. You ain't got to be nice to nobody.
He's just being honest with the fans. And that's the great heel right there. Telling it the way that it is, and people being pissed off at it because of their own insecurities. That's a heel.
He doesn't have to be nice to anybody. Jason, he told you guys plenty of stories about how he didn't mind making enemies over the course of his life. In fact, it's almost like he thrived on like getting people mad at him and like facing off with them. I mean, he did. You know, Stossel is probably exhibit A. They said, don't talk to this guy. Jesse Ventura said, don't talk to Dr. D because something like this could happen.
The crazy thing is he can back it up. He's the toughest guy probably in the whole arena that night. So he can get away with saying whatever the hell he wants. Like, he is absolutely fearless. And I think that is what I love in a heel, like somebody who is just so authentic. Like, that is what I love most about wrestlers, is when they really feel authentic, and he is like the definition of it.
And like, and the fact that like in his prime, he also has like a curly perm, you know, so he has this very crazy, weird, I don't even know what that is. It's, I guess it's disco-y to an extent, but It's a weird mixture of styles clashing, but I do love it, and it made him very unique.
You think he hit his razors in his hair?
He definitely could have.
Hopefully not when you guys went to visit him. I mean, so a guy who clearly is comfortable being in confrontational situations, and you could hear the tremor in Jason and Evan's voices talking about approaching the man's manse to get a sense of what we're talking about.
Yeah, he thrives on it. Like, he thrived on, even when we were with him, like just kind of like pushing buttons or just seeing how far he could take things. Like, I'm sure you could see that in the Raw interview, that like he is just, you know, he's almost like giddy about, you know, seeing how far he can take it.
He thrives on confrontation. Like, he wants somebody to take it over the line so then he can, you know, whack you in the head with a foreign object.
That's the rush, right? That someone might come at you and you got to be ready.
It's no surprise, and we haven't mentioned it, but it's no surprise that his other profession outside of wrestling after, you know, those days were behind him following the Stossel incident, he went full-fledged into bounty hunting, and it's no shock that that's the profession that he found because he's perfect for it. He would kick down any door, go into any situation, and he could handle himself just fine.
Look at him, too. He's used to working on individual paydays. He's used to getting in people's faces. He's used to taking people down, roughing them up if necessary. Yeah, being a bounty hunter is like, it's a perfect job for this psycho.
It's the same job, but without the bumps, you know? You don't got to take the bumps.
Oh, he gets to no-sell the whole every time. It's perfect.
But it wasn't a perfect job for his dear old mother, a God-fearing Pentecostal woman. And that's what's great about a lot of these clips is he's got that gentlemanly twang, you know, at the same time that he's telling these outrageous stories. He sounds like a dangerous guy, but he also has just a little bit of Southern charm to him. And where does that come from? It probably comes from his mom, who was not a huge fan of the kinds of traits that we heard in that first bite that David Schultz celebrated about himself. She didn't necessarily love the fact that her son was out there wreaking havoc all the time. There was a particular angle that he did that he talked to you guys about where he beat up sort of an undersized Indian opponent. By Indian, I believe he means like someone playing a Native American character down in the Memphis territory. He couldn't remember the guy's name, but he was wrestling him and at a certain point jumped out of the ring and this character apparently was playing some drums and Dr. Schultz grabs him, told him to stop playing the drums and causing him to lose the match, I guess, by way of distraction. So he goes over there and wears this kid out. To his memory, he was like 13, 14 years old. And you better believe that his mom was not keen, even though she knew it was a work, on that behavior.
My mother, you know, she was a Pentecostal, God-fearing lady, wouldn't lie for nobody or nothing. I come home one day and she said, David, I'm gonna tell you, I had to go in and drop down on my knees and ask God to forgive me what I thought when you hit that little Indian boy and busted his head open. I said, Mama, listen, he didn't get hurt. Oh, I seen it. And what I thought, I had to ask for forgiveness. You know, my mother was just, she wouldn't lie to save a person's life. She God-fearing Pentecostal woman, and that's the way it was, you know. And I told her, Mama, this boy's not hurt. Well, I seen you hit him, David, and you busted his head open and this here and this. Yeah. And I said, he's okay. Yeah, but he was just a young boy. And I said, oh, God, okay. All right, don't watch it no more. And she said, I probably won't because I can't get that out of my mind. God bless her. You know, that's the way she was, though. And a lot of people out there like that. Because when you go out and take a young boy and you hold him up in front of the camera and you hit him right in front of the camera like this and his face is right here and when you pick him back up, he's bleeding completely, needing stitches. It's hard to convince them that you didn't hurt that boy. And that's what I was trying to do, convince them that I was hurting this boy without hurting him.
That's one of my favorite subjects with, you know, when we're talking to these wrestlers on the road, is especially wrestlers of that era, because they always have great stories about keeping kayfabe with the family, you know, and how to not smarten up the family, you know, whether it's a younger sibling, mother, father, you know, they always have great stories about that. And here's a perfect evidence of that. And I totally remember, you know, as I've always said on this show, now it's all coming back to me, but I totally remember him telling us that story. And yeah, it's that fine line where, you know, they're still not going to fully smarten up the family.
Yeah. And it sounds like in that clip, he's still not fully explaining it to his mom. He's just telling her that, like, he didn't hurt him, but not explaining
it's a work.
Yeah, it's a work.
Yeah. He didn't necessarily tell her that he was in on it, the other guy.
I think if it got to it, I think, and his mom was really, really going crazy about it, I think he might tell her that it was fake.
It's hard to detect from that clip. It's just, you don't forget that when you can't talk your own mom off the ledge. But he's probably also very proud of that fact. That's the thing about the heel of his vintage.
He's one of the biggest, staunchest defenders of kayfabe there is. I mean, that's kind of what this episode is about.
Yeah, good guys and bad guys don't fraternize on the road, the whole thing. You do not share a beer. You don't go to Shoney's with your opponent, he said, he was sure to say. He's picturing one guy in particular going to Shoney's, I imagine, when he said that. But we mentioned the AWA, and this, of course, was Vern Gagne's territory, one of the biggest territories in the country for decades out of Minneapolis, one of the many, like Black Saturday and Georgia Championship Wrestling, that Vince McMahon eventually sort of foreclosed on and moved into the territory. Hulk Hogan was there when Vince took him in December of 83, a big headliner for the AWA at the time, and one of Hulk Hogan's chief foils in the AWA was Dr. D. David Schultz, one of the biggest heels in the territory, and they were actually working a ton of matches in different cities across the AWA circuit in December of 1983 when Vince McMahon hired across Hulk Hogan without Vern Gagne necessarily knowing it was happening until it was too late, and the same thing happened with Dr. D. Dr. Schultz got into WWF at a really heady time for the organization. It kind of explains why ABC would want to be lurking around doing a piece in the first place. But so the way he sets up this story, David Schultz, that is, Vince has gotten Hogan, and Hogan no-showed some matches in the AWA that he was supposed to have against David Schultz. And so David Schultz, unbeknownst to Vern, was also on the hook going to WWF himself, is on television in AWA calling out Hulk Hogan, calling him out for no-showing the matches against him, saying he's scared. And Vern Gagne wasn't sure why David Schultz was going out there calling attention to the fact that Hulk Hogan missed these dates. And Dr. D told you guys that he simply told Vern, you know, I got a plan. That's why I'm doing it. I got a plan. Trust me. And then Vince McMahon placed the call that it was time for Dr. Schultz also to jump over to the New York territory. And Vern found out what the plan was. And Dr. D takes us from there.
Vince called me and said, David, when you go in to do TV today, tell Vern you're leaving. Quit. Don't do the TV. So I went in and told Vern, I said, Vern, I'm leaving. I'm not going to be doing TV no more. And there was a few words exchanged, and he told me, get the hell out of the TV. Get out of here, you know. And I said, well, I'll leave. If you don't get out, I'll throw you out or what, you know. And I'm thankful that Vern didn't try to throw me out, because he would have threw me out on my head probably. I mean, Vern was a tough guy. He knew how to shoot. He could take care of himself. So, you know, he did me a favor by not trying to throw me out, because I told him, you're an old man now. You're not as young as you used to be. I don't think you can throw me out, you know. And he just kind of, I'm glad he didn't, because he would have more likely thrown me out of my head, you know.
Why would he have been so upset that you were leaving him?
He was upset because he was pushing me everywhere, main event, Hogan and myself, for the last 2 weeks. And then we show up the arenas. Hogan didn't show up. Somebody else had to come in and work, whoever it may be. And now I go back and do other interviews. Hey, you didn't show up last week. You're scared. What happened? And they said, well, they had some problems. This here. And Vern was in the dark. He had no idea Hogan had went to Vince.
It's a bit of a hostile takeover, and JP, we've talked a lot about this era in WWF on The Lapsed Fan. This is, mean Gene Okerlund comes in from AWA, Bobby Heenan comes in, eventually Jesse Ventura comes in, Schultz, Hogan. It's just like a mass exodus all of a sudden, and Dr. D was a key part of that.
I think it was one of the Coliseum videos where we kind of saw that, one of those early incarnations of the WWE version of Hogan versus Dave Schultz, and it's such a crazy period when you really think about how Vince McMahon is basically just picking and choosing who he wants. Like he's apple picking.
And he doesn't just do that. He turns around and goes right into Minneapolis with the match.
That's right. That's what happened. Exactly. He has that match with those two guys in Minneapolis.
I wonder, Evan, as I'm going through the transcript, and Jason as well, feel free to weigh in. I wonder if there was a sense that, you know, Dr. D did this to, you know, get over to Vince, and I don't know if this is a favor, but it doesn't sound like it's exactly the way David Schultz would have preferred to leave Vern, and had a little bit of trepidation about it. I wonder if he felt like that should have engendered him some more loyalty, but within a few months, you know, according to Dr. D, Vince has sort of thrown him under the bus for the John Stossel thing.
It's hard to know exactly, because you wonder if it was, and I didn't ask him this, or maybe I don't remember asking him this, you know, but they must have been drawing a lot of money, those two together. He and Hogan were very close, too. So you have to kind of also wonder what Hogan is telling Dr. D at this point.
Mm.
And Well, go ahead, Jason. Yeah,
I was going to say too. I think from what I remember is that Vince made all these promises to David Schultz. Like he like told him he was going to get paid like so much money that he was going to be taken care of for like the rest of his life. So it was, I think, like it seemed like a good idea for David, and and like him being friends with Hogan, I thought he thought there would be like loyalty there, like because. That was one thing I think we were really interested in too, is like hearing the stories of these guys, like before they were, you know, megastars, and especially Hulk Hogan, who is someone I grew up with. He was like a, you know, a comic book superhero to me. And so now to hear these stories of him sleeping on David Schultz's couch and, you know, he was playing in a band at the time when David knew him, and he like helped Hogan, like, you know, get his like start in the business as well. So it was cool to like hear the story of these two friends, you know, kind of coming up in the business together. And then one goes to this company and then, you know, wants to bring his friend along as well too. So I think like David thought there was going to be some loyalty there and some financial stability.
And it looks in the episode like he took you out to like a storage locker of sorts where he had a lot of mementos of him and Hulk before he was the WWF Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, that is what Jason was mentioning, that he had these what do you call them? Like these like giant storage containers almost, like these freight, you know, storage containers. And they're amazing. And he had so much, he had everything in there you could want. All the documents from the various court cases that he's been involved with. And yeah, it was just fascinating, you know, to see all this stuff. And he kept everything. There's nothing that he ever got rid of.
Yeah. And he had those like photos of like him and Hogan when they were like young. And there was like one great photo where he like flips it around and, what did it say? It was like,
he looks at the photo of him and Hogan and there's something that he scratched out at the back.
Yeah. It wasn't like old friend, don't remember his name or something like that. Like,
that it was. Yeah. He's like, oh, old friend, don't remember his name. You know, written on the back of a photograph of them together. Amazing. So great.
Very telling.
Very telling. Yeah. He definitely has a similar sort of circular relationship with Hulk Hogan as he does Vince McMahon, as he tells these stories, although much deeper ties that he thought binded between him and Hulk. I mean, Hulk brings him along for the big payday and the big gravy train of the AWA to the WWF for a reason. So he kind of talks to you guys about how the distance slowly but surely is created between him and Hulk, who, of course, from really day one, within weeks of coming into the WWF, is world champion and just off to the races with the Hulkamania phenomenon and all of that. But also in the spirit of kayfabe, as we're talking about all this stuff, and in the spirit of, you know, kind of like forging an alliance in his mind, perhaps, with Vince McMahon, during the interview, he kind of talks about how the John Stossel incident wasn't the only one in which Vince, according to Schultz at least, told Dr. D to kind of go out into the wild and do some dirty work for me. Sort of a job he had to do. Here's a story he tells about a guy who, according to Dr. D, Vince felt was exposing the business outside of the arena, that he was talking to people on the street about how it wasn't real and showing them the tricks, showing them how with just a quick scrape of the forehead with your thumbnail, you can draw blood if you have all that scar tissue, and how the blood isn't, you know, drawn from real hits in the ring and all this stuff. And here is what Dr. D said Vince told him to do about it.
I know Vince come to me and he said, David, I need this guy out of the business. He's down here talking to these little kids in the neighborhood. And he's up here scratching his head with his fingernail and telling kids that all that blood and stuff, you know. He said, see, I just scratched my head and all. He said, we need to get him out of the business. This is just one of many that Vince had me to put out of the business. And I went out with this boy and I said, how long you want him out? For a week? Forever. So I went out and separated his shoulder and I don't know, they say he almost lost his eye. He didn't, from a headbutt, and took him, separated his shoulder and dislocated his knee, all with one move. And they had to take him out of the ring, and I never seen him again. But that's what I was supposed to do. That's what I was getting paid to do. And then, I never told him to do that. Yeah, right, yeah. And, you know, I was that way, man. I mean, boss tell me to do something, I do it.
That may have turned out to be the problem. It's great, Jason, hearing you guys sort of ask for all the detail about this, trying to get a recre out of it. You're like, so how did you break your shoulder? When did you do it? What did he look like? And he's like, his limited memory of it, because as he said, this was one of many incidents like this, to hear him tell it, where he was deputized to, just, like I said, do some dirty work.
This kind of gets into the whole situation between Vince and Dr. D, right? Because going right into the John Stossel thing, it's kind of a similar thing where Vince says one thing and that's like, you know, okay, someone's given me permission to like fuck somebody up, you know, where it's like, you're like, hey, David, there's a guy over here, you know, and we need him to not do that, what it, you know, whatever he's doing. And then David's like, okay, I'm going to go fucking separate his shoulder and smash his head into a brick wall or whatever. You know, he does like this. It's lost in translation a little bit between, like, I think, you know, what he's given permission to exactly do or how he's interpreting, you know, what one person is telling him to do. No one's saying, hey, go over there, headbutt him, separate his shoulder, you know, slap John Stossel. I don't know if that's the words that are coming out of the mouth, but, you know, it's kind of giving when you are giving David any sort of permission to do anything, you know, he's going to take his own liberties. At least that's how I read into it, you know?
The most chilling thing about that, about him telling that story, is how casually he recounts it.
Yeah, he doesn't change the inflection of his voice when he's talking about ruining somebody for life and his dear mom.
He's just like, he's just like, nope, this is what happened, and I had to do it. Because the boss told me to do it. Like, fuck.
Yeah, that's a bounty hunter in the making for sure. Oof. Well, this does, as you telegraph there, Evan, translate, you know, sort of create a transition rather nicely to the John Stossel incident. If you watch the episode, you know all about it. Heck, if you didn't watch the episode, you've probably heard all about it, and as Evan mentioned, seen it on YouTube and whatnot. But Jason, how did you guys and Evan get John Stossel? That's the first thing, because when I watched this episode, that's what blew me away, is suddenly John Stossel, who's the best carny of the whole episode, in my opinion, is looking at me in my living room and just mercilessly recounting this.
I know. Yeah. And the pain went away when I got paid.
Be still my wrestling fan heart when he said that.
The heel promo of a lifetime right there. Yeah, it was pretty cool that we were able to get him. I remember our series producer that was working with us, Alex McIntosh at the mm-hmm. time, was really vigilant at trying to get John Stossel in the show. It was tough for us to get enough voices for that show, because it's really four people, right? It's Dr. D, Jim Cornette, Eddie Mansfield, and John Stossel. And so we knew that, like, the episode would come to life if we had the other, you know, the other perspective on it. And I do remember that when we did the interview, we were told that John was only going to give us 30 minutes, and that was it. So almost everything you see in the episode is what we got.
With one exception that I'm harboring here, that I'm holding in my bosom so that can be deployed at the correct time. But
wait, did I give you the John Stossel transcript?
You more than gave it to me, my friend.
Oh, shit.
Do you remember what the original idea was? And David really wanted us to get him and John Stossel in the room together. I remember we even went so far as to drawing, like, floor plans of, like, what that would look like.
That's right. That's right.
Got to save that for posterity. That's hilarious.
Dr. D says a lot, like, nah, if I can just get John Stossel, you know, and this is like right after, you know, a shoulder separating story. But he's like, no, I'm not going to hurt him. I'm just going to talk to him, you know, give him a big hug.
I don't expect you to know this, but we have a bit of sound right down that alley. But quickly, before we move on from that, we talk all the time on Lapsed Fan about wrestlers are kind of shallow manipulators, that they're really good at manipulating, but they're not quite as good as they think they are. When I see John Stossel, I see this guy is like primo kayfabe, this guy.
His animosity towards the wrestling business. And it's like, but this guy, I get the vibe. He's just playing a heel, you know, like I listen to him and he's playing a character here. I don't know if he gives two shits one way or the other about wrestling in actuality, but for this thing, he's like, I'm coming after this fucking thing. And he was funny.
Yeah.
He made me laugh quite a bit. And I just loved it. He's just such, like, if you listen to the Lapsed Fan, he reminded me very much of our Lapsed editor character.
Yeah. Like a newspaper editor who like insists on saying it's fake in the second paragraph, even though it has nothing to do with the story. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jason, was it standoffish, or Evan, was it standoffish with him, or because you had such tight time, you couldn't get a rapport going? What was?
Oh yeah. I was just going to say that it was like, okay, you know, like the meter's running, you know, when he sits down in the chair. And I do remember also this bitterness, this inherent bitterness, interviewing Stossel, that I have to come here and talk about this still, you know, like I'm still talking about this.
John, you want to know a secret, John? You want to know a secret, John? This is all anybody cares about.
He was a broadcasting legend.
Not anymore. Doesn't matter.
I think he even says in either the episode or the interview where he's like, nobody cares about the years of reporting I did on, you know, such and such and this and that, you know, and then, but this is the thing, you know. And so there was a lot of that energy of like, I'm having to do, but hey, he still showed up and did it. And, you know, he killed it. Talk about nailing a half an hour interview. He certainly did.
Yeah, you got your money's worth.
Yeah, exactly.
Half hour. Yeah, probably. It's taken you 3 hours to get that much good stuff out of some guys that you've sat down with. So that happens. The slap incident happens, and Schultz gets into it in good detail in the episode about the fallout. According to Schultz, Vince told him, good job, go back to the hotel till things cool down, and looks like he's going to press charges. It's getting a little more out of hand than I thought. Of course, Schultz's story is that Vince, you know, didn't tell him to slap him in as many words, but told him to, you know, what was it, give him a good jostling or whatever it was. And so Vince pays a fine to the New York State Athletic Commission, according to David Schultz, that the commission brought down on Schultz for hitting Stossel backstage. And Schultz says Vince sent him to Japan to do some matches out there and sort of wait out the controversy. And all the way along, sort of convincing him that you're on his side, you know, that we're doing this, just we're in this together, we'll pay the fine, it's fine, don't worry about it, you know, just lay low and then turn around and tell the other side of the altercation that we're really sorry, this guy's a problem and we know it.
He's such a, method heel, shall we say, that he's so good at what he does. But when it's in the interest of the right people at the right time, it's the best. It's the best for business until it isn't. And then when it isn't, it's so easy to just vilify him. And I think that's what he found very quickly. Because, hey, I mean, having allegiance and having friends and honor and, you know, people who you can trust in this business are very rare, if not non-existent, you know. And I think that's a really hard lesson that he learned, especially in all of this that he would go through, you know, with WWF and Vince in particular. I always think about, like, when Dr. D got out of the business, it was kind of like, that was probably almost right about, you know, the limit that Dr. D could have gone in the business before things started to kind of button up more, you know, and you couldn't be as outlaw and you couldn't be as unpredictable and violent, you know, and things would change. And you can't imagine like seeing a Dr. D on TV, WWF TV in the 90s. I mean, you could, but, you know, then it would be a neutered version, you know. So
and Jim Cornette talks about too in the episode how, like, you know, they needed to legitimize wrestling too. And there was this pressure to make it feel legit. So like that was what David Schultz's job was, in a way, was to,
right,
to be that kind of like enforcer for the company.
You guys have a money moment. You ask him, of course, you guys are so good at this, if Vince apologized to you, would you accept his apology? His response is tremendous. Listen to Dr. D ask that question by the crew.
If Vince called to apologize for throwing you under the bus, would you accept it?
No.
Why?
After 40 years, he's going to call me and apologize? First, I ain't going to apologize to nobody for nothing. He got too big an ego. And, you know, the only way he could apologize to me is go in the ring with me, lock the gates, put a cage around it, two men enter, one man leave. Me and him. Old people, we could have our wheelchairs together, our walkers, and fight to the finish. But that ain't going to happen either, you know. He's running around too scared of all that, you know.
All right, well, that begs the question, though, doesn't it? What about John Stossel? What if John Stossel apologized? Or if you saw John Stossel again, do you think you guys could reconcile?
If you were in a room with John Stossel today, what would you say to him?
Well, I don't know. I'd have to see how he responded first. I mean, John, I don't hold nothing against John Stossel. John Stossel was used and set up like I was. John Stossel just should have picked his words a lot better. He should have been a lot better journalist than he was by coming out there and say those words the way he said it. I don't think that appropriate for any situation to call somebody's business a fake. I mean, that's like calling me a crook. That's, you know, and after all the injuries I had, all the pain I went through to be a pro wrestler and to make it in pro wrestling, and he comes out there and gonna call me a fake. He could have called me a cartoon character, that's fine. Exhibitionist, that's fine. A Looney Tune, that's fine. Redneck, that's fine. Anything. Not fake. I'm not a fake, you know. And I think he understands that now. I think he does.
Does he, Dr. D? Does he understand that? As promised. Hey, John Stossel, would you accept Dr. D's apology? Or actually, put more artfully, if he was standing in front of you right now, what might you say?
If there's something you would could say to David Schultz now, what would you say to him now?
Fuck you, David. And Vince, I guess I got over it. I don't know that you told him to do it. I think he apologized at the time, and I want to believe it was sincere.
Well, guys, wrapping up our thoughts on the good doctor, Evan, Jason, I mean, what an experience. You colored it in so nicely, going out to meet the man on the compound and winning his trust, and you got some gold out of this guy. It's a bygone era he speaks to, and a one-of-a-kind kind of you know, ethic that is totally gone from wrestling now.
I don't want to call it an insecurity, but I can see how, you know, being called a fake would be hurtful to someone like him, because he could kill anyone, you know, and he could injure, and he's tougher than most in this industry. He's in the 1% of the toughest of the tough, right? And so I think for him to have to, you know, make excuses, you know, or be in a business that isn't legitimate where he could survive if it was, you know, I think that hurts extra for someone like him, because he is the real deal. You know, he is 100% the real deal.
Yeah, definitely. And like, I'll never forget like our 2 days that we had with him, like on his compound, hanging out with him, watching him shooting guns into the forest. It was so crazy. And hanging out with his wife, Peggy, too, who I think was probably our biggest regret, was we couldn't convince her to be in the show.
Couldn't.
And she is so cool. And she had been with him since they were like teenagers. She would, you know, run the bounty hunting business. She would be the one sending him out on the calls and taking the calls and tracking down where these people were. And when you see some of like the old footage, some of the tapes that we found, like there was like a Japanese expose on them doing their bounty hunting work, you tell like this was obviously like the inspiration for Dog the Bounty Hunter. Yes, but
that's right.
I think like when we saw like their dynamic, him and Peggy like together, like that's where like the hard exterior kind of like went away, and you saw like they are like best friends, and that was so cool to see, like a relationship where like after like 50 years they are still best friends. They were hanging out. They were cracking jokes and flirting with each other. It was honestly like a relationship to be inspired by.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really cool. And she would make us lunches every day. And they were so like hospitable. But there was always a gun and like arm's reach.
It was a pretty wild experience. Shout out, Peggy.
Yeah. And their home was incredible. Like when he eventually allowed us to come inside the home. After just where he probably just saw us like dying and melting out there. When you go in there, he had like all these amazing artifacts that he collected from sometimes when, like, I don't know how it worked, but like it was either, I think it was mostly from the bounties that he got. Like he would sometimes just get, or I don't know how he obtained these things. Like he just like collected them. So there was like he said it was like this cross, like a religious cross that was on Christopher Columbus's boat. And I just remember there was a bunch of objects in there that I just couldn't believe. These things are just like in the middle of nowhere down a dirt road, and storage lockers filled with wrestling memorabilia.
It's awesome.
That's our little tour through the mind of Dr. D, David Schultz, this week on Dark Side of the Ring Unheard. That'll do it for us this week. And again, don't forget to tune in to the season finale of this season of Dark Side of the Ring. It's coming up Tuesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern Time on Vice TV with a look at Black Saturday. You do not want to miss it. For now and for us, it's back to the vault, and we'll see you next time on Dark Side of the Ring Unheard.